Again, welcome. Welcome, everyone. Chilly evening here in Seattle. The week between Thanksgiving, week after Thanksgiving. The reason I read the poem, and for those of you who are watching the video, the poem is called Listen by W.S. Merwin, and you can read it. It might be better to read it prior to this Dharma talk. But it really expresses a kind of orientation, I think, to life in general when we're birthing the heart, which is the topic of the theme of the topics that we're involved in currently. And that there's just can't be any wavering. I know many of us deliberate on the conditions of the world and often lose hope within those conditions and sense a kind of despair often. That can be a temporary holding pattern for us, but it doesn't really matter. We just keep going the only direction we can. And as expressed by this particular poem, it was towards that sense of appreciation. And as bad and as dark as it might be, we still bow to the life that's before us. And we do everything we can within our interactions to move in the direction of the heart, into an opening, into a clear, intimate connection. And so this afternoon, or this evening, I'm going to speak about a relinquishment as the topic of choice. And I thought it was a good one for the holiday season because it expresses a kind of gift of the holidays. If we orient ourselves in proper posture to the holidays, I think we can sense how this word works in coordination and connection with Thanksgiving and with the different holidays that are occurring throughout this next month. And the sense of simplicity is held within that word, the sense of silence and stillness, the sense of existence, as I'm using that word, is sort of the bare natural actuality of what we are as human beings, that sense of existence in us. And that we keep sort of loading on different layers to ourselves, that we build throughout our life, layer after layer, and each of those layers become a kind of burden to us and for us. And those layers, they can get very dense. There's layers, by what I mean by layers are wherever we are holding on to life in terms of our self-definitions, those forms of self-images or how possessions possess us, and all of our different responsibilities and all of the busyness of our life. Layer after layer, we feel it, with each increased layer, a limitation of some sort, a burden, a sense of something missing in us, but also a kind of containment of us, of that existence that we know is there. And we get very comfortable within kind of a rote mentality, a kind of conditioned mentality within it all, doing this at this speed throughout the day, responding in this direction throughout the day, and then having our leisure time in the evening often filled with other events. And it's useful, I think, especially when the holiday season is upon us, to sort of assess where we are within all those layers, all that piling on, all that burden. Just to take a pause, to take a moment and step back consciously from ourselves and ask a very serious and sincere question about whether our life is moving in the direction we want it to move, given how we're moving and within what influences we're moving from and out of. And I think it's very helpful to do that because this sense of relinquishment is a word that can refresh us if we use the word in its right alignment. We're not very good with that word in the West because we have a very limited yield factor in the West. We're willing to give up a little. We're willing to move and adjust a little bit. But certainly we contain our comfort zone. We don't want to lose a certain threshold of comfort that we have grown accustomed to. And we aren't willing to relinquish anything that feels threatening to our sense of comfort and security. It's interesting because in the East, where the suffering is, the physical suffering is more obvious, there's a deeper yield in the East. People are willing to adjust in greater amounts than we are in the West. And even for some of us who have been within the Dharma for a number of decades, we find ourselves having slightly been slightly more maneuverable now than we were when we started. You know, we still expect it all to sort of fit into the package of what we consider the threshold of our needs, the threshold of our comfort levels. And yet the Dharma really moves forward in growth along with that, with our edges, where we're caught within our expectations of comfort. And for us not even to consider those edges, it can be a real limitation of the way we practice. You know, many of us probably are only willing to sit with a certain mental quietude. If it's too noisy when we sit down, well, sitting just isn't working for us today, and up we get. Or if the house is too noisy, or if something's going on that may not require our involvement but upsets our sensitivity to noise, or the commotions around us, well, it's just not the right time to be still, to be quiet. The comfort level isn't correct. And we somehow have built our definition of meditation to accompany that comfort level. And we think that meditation is an avenue into that deep level of comfort that we have grown accustomed. When the house is empty, when we are at our maximum aliveness and energy, when we're well fed, when our minds are sufficiently quiet, now I can sit. And what a wonderful sitting I had. But twist the knobs a little in any direction and suddenly it doesn't quite work for us. And I'd like us to test that. I'd like us to push ourselves a little into the edges of our comfort level. And I'm not at all suggesting that we threaten our physical needs of safety. But the mind is, the threshold of comfort is far, far away from those physical and mental survival needs. And the affluence of us all has gotten us accustomed to a kind of apathy of what life is outside of this culture. I don't know, I was watching 60 Minutes this week and they had one of their segments on the World Food Program. It was about refugees streaming out of Syria into Jordan, some million of them, and we were following some of those refugees crossing desert-like areas. And just the abject existence that they're living, you know, never having, not only not having a place under their feet, but this particular program was also concerned about the ability for this, for the hunger for the food to sustain itself, because it was running out of money. Since then, I've heard that also on some of the public radio programs. So you look at that, and you're sitting, you know, I'm sitting in my comfortable living room and watching a million people at the edge of their own existence, and you know, really having plenty. And the thought occurred to me, you know, I have to give something to that. The heart was moved. I mean, it's not like I can go there and help feed the people. That's not a possibility. But what can I do? You know, you just are stirred to a certain level of action. I hope all of us are when we see that. It's something in us is moved. And so often we're moved, but it's within a kind of restrained comfort. You know, well, it's almost a pity that I have mine and they don't have theirs, and let me just give something to try to, you know, it's almost like giving to, because I have so much. I don't know, there's an inequality in that. There isn't a true sharing. But when the heart speaks, you want to relinquish. You know, not so that you're threatened or your safety is threatened. I'm not suggesting, you know, giving away your bank account. I'm suggesting letting the heart speak, have its true voice within the sharings that we express, within the thank yous, within the appreciations, within the full range of voice that our heart does tone, and to really exercise that sufficiently. And, you know, I mean, I don't think there's a better season in which to exercise that. And when I say that, I want to emphasize two, an embodied practice is not one that's theoretical, it's one that's actual. When you're confronting and connecting with, through an intimate connection with life, you're feeling the pains of that life. We've talked a lot about that. And to let that have its own expression in action and connection and intimacy and dialogue. And simultaneous to that is the common core of existence that we all have. Now, this is actually an important point, because there are two levels of reality that we work on simultaneously. One is that very interactive spirit, that one that interfaces with each other, that communes and communicates, and is based very much in thought and time, and works from the individual level. And then there's the other that is timeless, the existence of life that is very timeless. And so whenever we see a word or have a word like relinquishment, which includes simplicity and letting go and surrender and renunciation, a lot of other words are synonymous with that word I'm just using tonight called relinquishment, we use it on both levels. At the most of the deepest and quietest level of existence, where there is no differentiation and quietude. Relinquishment means one thing. It means sort of releasing the burden of our accumulated existence. Right? It's the ability to release the layers that I mentioned, the layers of our images, the layers of our accumulation, the all the ways we have defined ourselves and our busyness and all the ways that we're entrapped within our life have led to a limited definition of that existence. But when we're willing to just release that back into the word, what the word means, which is itself just the bare existence of our life, just the bare existence of it. We lose nothing by giving those things up, by relinquishing the needless pile-on of all of our self-acclaim, of all of our, all of it. And so we work on that level. We work on that level very pointedly, very focused. But at the same time, relinquishment means something else as well. At the interactive level, at the individual level, at the human level, when you're looking into the eyes of the homeless, when you're looking and sharing or seeing on TV the desperation of a million refugees, it also means there's also an opening there of communion. And within that level, within the level of individuation, there's also a stubbornness there. You know, I don't want to relinquish. I want to protect my comforts. I want what I have, and I'll give the excess away. And we're afraid that in somehow the word relinquishment is a threatening word to us. It's going to ask us to do something that we don't want to do. And so there's this back draft of resistance to the word. And that forms an argument in the mind about, well, you know, that's just their condition. You know, why were they living in Syria anyway? As if, you know, and so you often the human being, the humanity is caught within that heart's need to genuinely commune and the back draft of our own thought about stubbornness, through stubbornness and just our unwillingness to, and also just tired of all this neediness around us, you know? People had it together, they would, all of that argument. And we're always caught in that. That's the nature of what it means to be alive, is that we're going to be caught in those two systems, the systems of individual contact and the greater existence that has much more united in formless existence that our spirit is evolving toward. And neither, they work simultaneously with each other. And as they work within harmony with each other, instead of letting the resistance of one level completely negate the other, which is our tendency to do, you know, is to go with the unconditioned and say, you know, it's all one and everything is, so why give to the needy when everybody, you know, all that silly argument. Or to go with the other, and just sort of broker it as a good human being. I should do this and I should do that and I need to grow this way and I need to grow that way. Those are the extremes within this beautiful symbiosis, this common meeting ground where those two levels of reality meet. Where at the moment that there is the acknowledgement of the common existence of us all, the formless reality of us all, there still is someone who needs $2 for a real change in front of you. And that does not deny, there's no dispute there. That is not those are not polarizing events. And you live within that, full-heartedly. And as we work with that, not contested or resisting, or pulling back in any way whatsoever, those two realities begin to mesh together. Right? And to live within the paradoxes of that is what it means to have a full spiritual life. We live within that paradox. Forever, forever, we will live within the paradox of the limited and the limitless. An embodied practice. And you can see, you know, that even as we give you words and give you subjects for the evening's talk, like relinquishment or love, or whatever word that we have brought up in the past that has connected with you, You can use that word in two different ways. You can use, you know, the word to dig yourself into a kind of contracted pit. I'm not loving enough. I should be more loving. Something that you'll never be able to live up to because of the limited nature of individuation and the limitations on form. You'll never live to the standard that you impose upon yourself, because that standard will always be idealistic. And so from time to time, to take a deliberate pause and to feel the intrinsic nature from the existence of the love that's already there, from the generosity of heart that already is there, without trying, you know, to cultivate it, without trying to manufacture more of it, but to see the bottomless well that is already there within us. And that takes a pause. It takes a pulling back. It takes a refreshing, conscious, quiet moment within ourselves to feel the reserve, the reservoir of what we already have within us. And to let that reservoir flood us, to flood us with the waters of from its source. And then, as the human comes back in, you'll see where it is that you still can't give in the way that your heart would like, and you feel the limitations of your own argument. That's okay. Because within that, you're holding it within the reservoir of love for you too. Not just love for the individual outside of you, but for the love of your own protest, for the limitation of your own consciousness, for the reserves that you have and the fear of you have of your own safety. You have love for that too. Is there love for this too? And as we work on ourselves and work upon those protests and quiet those protests, not through pressure or suppression, but through listening to those protests and seeing that they don't really have much worth in terms of their wording or their assumptions, and then we find that we have greater access to the heart and that reservoir that lies within. But it doesn't deny working on ourselves individually and trying to be more loving and trying to push ourselves a little bit beyond the edge of where we can love in that moment, or where we can relinquish in that moment and let go and release, even if that edge seems to be a question of, you know, sort of a line that we've drawn for our whole life. I don't want to go across this. We might want to just extend ourselves, feel what it's like to go across that line, to feel what it's like to give beyond what you thought was acceptable at an earlier time. So again, those two work together, and I get very, at this age, I get a little bit irritated with us backing ourselves in one corner or the other. The corner of absolute existence where, you know, it's all one and nothing needs to be done, and the other corner of the sense of self and the all constantly cultivating and working and self-improving. Those are the extremes, but those two extremes meet together in a very symbiotic and communal way. So to take relinquishment and start seeing what existence is. I mean, that's a beautiful way to do it. Okay, so what is it in this moment? What can be released in this moment? What is piled up? What am I assuming? What are the layers that are covering my existence in this moment? And can I relinquish those? Can I just release them? Can I come back to the quietude? Because it was all quiet at one point. Said in the song, Silent Night. You know, it was a silent night, holy night. We were all silent night at one point. And then we started adding those layers of self-definition. And they piled on. And we lost ourselves within all of that. We lost our definition, we lost our way, we lost our ability to touch one another, to commune. So what does it look like? It's not very far away. That silent night is intrinsic to our existence. And because we never lost the existence, we've never lost the silence either. And therefore, if we're willing to just release some of the edges where we think we need for our self-protection, for our sense of self-definition, for our defensiveness, the contention, the contrast, the contraction. If you just, through the intention, I just want to see what it's like to go back to the silent night, to the holy night. And it's that close. It's that close. The existence has never gone away. That's what's so beautiful about spiritual practice, is that we're never more than one sentence away from it, from one thought away from it. And we can find our way back very quickly, and we can be refreshed by that well of existence, that well of common, of the common, of the interconnected. Conscious connection. So you see, it's a good time of year to ask what's important. Is it not? Because what's coming at us, especially in the next month, is clutter. That's what's coming at us. For every true moment of spiritual authenticity in the next month, there are 1,000 moments of clutter. What catches our ear? What do we listen to? Do we listen to the silent night? Or Santa Claus is coming to town? See, so there's this. And what is where is the holy? Where is the sacred? See, just you could just feel it. You could feel the well of it, even as we pull ourselves back in from the externalization of the clutter. And so, let's look at some ways to encourage relinquishment for the next, I was going to say next month, but for the rest of our life, really. And the first thing is start by relinquishing painful thoughts. I mean, that's not asking a lot. They're hurt. They hurt. So you want to pull, you know, you want to pull the splinter out of your finger. And so thoughts that have to do with time, thoughts that have to do with the burdensome of my past, thoughts that have to do with the expectation and fear of my future, those thoughts are so obviously burdensome, so obviously painful. It's a good time to relinquish those, isn't it? It's just a good time to sort of stand up to ourselves, you might say. Enough of this self-abuse and these habit patterns that keep being played through our lives and the reactions from within those habit patterns and the assumptions that we keep moving on, those projected assumptions like I know what you're thinking about me and therefore I'm thinking about you in retaliation for what you just thought about me. All of that nonsense, that insanity, it's a good time to pull back, don't you think? Isn't that the season? Isn't this the season? If we want to find the true reservoir of the heart, we have to stop the insanity. We have to encourage this flooding, this flooding of the heart. It's helpful as a second way towards encouraging relinquishment to know the difference to what the true source of happiness is in life. Because we're right at a crossroads here where, you know, everything that is technologically out there, all the images that are coming at us will tell us that the true source of happiness is in the commercialization, is in the marketing of all this, the purchase of all that. Even though deeply we know that, don't we? We know that. Still, you see, that's what I mean by our comfort level. We never take it. We still try to milk something long after we know its uselessness. Still, but we know it. We know that. There isn't a person in the room that doesn't know that. So why don't we live it? Because somehow we fear our comfort level will be compromised if we don't energetically move in that direction. Even when it's a useless item to you. And beside that, there are a million people living in squalor conditions flooding in to Lebanon. Side by side. I mean, it's deeply disturbing when we have enough for our own security for the rest of our life, and that's not enough. In the face of the need that's out there, there is a retention. It's amazing to me that some people truly believe that no matter how much they have, it's not enough. I don't know what they think is going to take it away. Like I would, if you have enough, you have enough. You do the math. You're going to live to be, let's say, 100. That's giving you a lot of years. You do the math, you've got enough. So what's, you see, it doesn't, not when you see a million people starving. See, this is at some point the heart just becomes more compelling than our need to constantly build our fortunes. And the third way I would encourage relinquishment is inviting simplicity. Most of us, again, it's fear of comfort. It's the fear that we're going to compromise our comfort level. Simplicity doesn't feel comfortable to us. And yet it's the essence of comfort. Simplicity holds everything that material wealth can never provide. What does it hold? Well, let's try contentment. Let's bring that one in. Well-being. Mental ease. You see, we've just been stoking the furnace of our own desires in this culture, and there's no more room for the logs on the fire. It's just we find the next way to throw something on it, burn it brighter. So look, what does this moment need? Let the heart settle with what is already here, rather than stoking the ambition of our expectations. And then we know relinquishment, and you don't want it. You know, it's not like you're being good. It's just, no thank you. I appreciate the offer, but no thank you. Or I have enough. And a fourth way that we can encourage relinquishment, and I think this is, in this culture, very important, and that's slowing our pace. I mentioned pause. How many of us take a deliberate pause from time to time? You see, it's because the logic of the continuity of busyness has its own pleasure. There's a logic to it. I'm needed, I'm purposeful, I'm important. Or there's a rush of endorphins that busyness gives us. And we just stay busy because the momentum is on its side. As I've mentioned many times, the hardest homework I give to beginning class is for them not to do anything but what they are doing in that moment. Which, what do you mean? Like everything rests upon what they're going to do, not upon what they are doing. Well, this is a more sophisticated group than me, a beginning class. Do we find those times to pause, break ourselves from the cycle of our own busyness? Are we willing to drop the hormonal uplift of staying mentally and physically busy? Is boredom threatening us? Or we think, oh my God, you know, if I let this thing down, I'll just be bored, I will be useless. See, that's the counter definition. That's the way the mind keeps itself within its own momentum, is by giving you an argument that if you stop doing what you're doing to perpetuate your momentum, it'll be disaster. You'll be bored. You'll be useless. How about you'll be awake? Wakefulness. Slowing down. Actually having a moment of contact with something. So you, not a cursory, but an intimate moment of contact where we're actually present. There's contact, there's connection actually there in that moment. I'm not moving on to something else, and it doesn't matter what that contact is with, because existence meets itself within that contact. And all things exist. Since all things are of existence, when we're not moving in relationship to the existence that's external, it meets itself. It meets itself. And it knows itself. How could it not? That's the culmination of existence meeting itself. In fact, that's what existence is attempting to do with our ignorance. It's coming back in to meet itself. You think you're doing it. You're not doing it. You're letting existence come back in to meet the place where you don't think you exist. And once you have agreed to that contract, once you have signed it with your intention, it's unrelenting, isn't it? And we say, we're slowing down. Well, what about beauty? What about creativity? What about love? No, it's just going to be boring. Well, if that scares you sufficiently, you'll stay within your own momentum. But if you want to see what creatively is there when boredom is challenged, you'll find beauty, creativity, and love, and connection. And so this sense of relinquishment, another encouraging way to move it is by just staying open. Whatever seems to indicate that we need to hold on, push that edge, release that edge, relinquish that edge, and see what's on the other side. That definition, that contraction, that assumption about life, that assumption about me, what's on the other side of that? I know what's on this side of it. Misery, really. What's on the other side of it? What if I just let it blow through the room like a breeze with the window open? What's on the other side of that? Boredom. In another and final way to encourage relinquishment is to remember our mortality. How long are you going to be here? And what are you going to be able to take with you that has been so important that throughout your 70 or 80 years you've accumulated and piled up? I've never seen anyone die with a money sack strapped to their waist. Doesn't go that way. You didn't come in with it, we're not going out with it. What do you want to go out with? How about a birthed heart? How about a caring and love that will nourish because it's from existence itself? Death can't take it away. Death can take everything that is non-existent. Our definitions, our assumptions, our intellectual properties, our investments. It can take nothing away that is alive. And when we sit in meditation, let us sit within relinquishment. So that it's all flowing, it's all moving. Nothing is being stuck. It's just all coming in and going out. Just like a continuous waterfall. Establishing no fixed position within any of them. Not adding another layer, but relinquishing everything. To find the source of existence itself. That is the spirit of meditation. The problem, of course, is that we define ourselves by what we hold on to. You can't define yourself by what you release. And so, from our limited defensive and protective space, the more we hold on, the more safe we feel. And relinquishment questions that edge, questions that need, questions that certainty of self-definition. So so that no matter what happens, it's the thank you. Thank you, said the poem. Thank you. The crooks in office, thank you. And thank you all. Can we sit for just a minute? So as you sit this evening, sit within relinquishment. No matter what attitude you might be holding, no matter what assumption, no matter what argument you might have, what if you just let it go? What if you didn't define yourself by all that? What would come up from the depths of your spirit that are trapped within the logic of your self-certainty? Isn't it worth finding out during this holiday season? Okay, so if there are any questions or comments about anything, or anything that I know about. Yes, sir. Gus, you're going to have to speak up because I'm That's nice. So he said he saw outside of a church a little sign, as they often have, that said, at the moment of death, you take, you leave behind everything you own and take with you everything you are. Okay, so I have a sense that you also take with you everything you think you are, which may not be which may not be the best luggage to carry. Okay, so but it's a beautiful reference for existence. we scare ourselves by projecting a nothing or a void into existence, or something, a no me, as if we knew what it was like, as if we had already experienced that and came back and now have the explanation. But we don't, of course. And I have never found any area of spiritual practice that limited me at all. In other words, whenever I crossed the assumption that it was going to limit me, what I found on the other side of that fence post was abundance, not the limitation I had expected. That's extremely true. That's true exponentially for the word existence. It's as if, you know, the Jack in the box was kept in the box, and then at the right moment it springs out and says, my God, why was I in that box all the time? You see? And that's what's happened. You know, whoa. Please don't shove me back into that. You'll have to, if you ask as loudly as you can and as concisely as you can so I can repeat it. Yes. Did you say you felt fear when you felt sense or? Oh, yes. She avoids silence because she has a lot of fear of silence. Well, first of all, you're not alone. You're in good company. Look at the heads nodding around you. I remember as a child, I'd have to walk my backyard at night sometimes to take out the trash. It was my job to do that. And there was a terror that would hit me about halfway down the yard. And because I felt existentially alone in this huge, you know, space. And I remember, depositing the trash as quickly as I could and running as fast as I could back to the house where the lights and the activity were. Well, there's some semblance of that in each one of us, where we feel most protected within the noise of our commonly shared space. And that's why we're as social of a creatures as we are, I think, at least one of the reasons. And there's a kind of way that the sense of I, the sense of me, the sense of our own definition keeps reclaiming itself within that noise. And that reclaiming sort of assures us that we're still here, because look, I'm speaking to myself through my thoughts. You know, I hold a sense of me internally, and that feels very reassuring. It's kind of like a baby blanket. And so that goes on for a long period of time until we test the edge of that. And I spoke tonight about skillfully spirituality will be meeting our edge continually. And one of the edges, if not the most important edge that we need to meet, is this one regarding quietude. Now, we don't have to do it all at once, but we have to acknowledge it when it's there and look around and see if it's as devastating as we believed it to be. There will be a time in your meditation where the mind will just be quiet. It won't be thinking as much. And instead of rushing back and filling that with more thoughts or stirring the pot of thought, just sit there for a moment and look around and feel what is missing. Ask yourself, what is missing in this moment? And the other side of that question, what is being fulfilled in this moment that thought never could? Right? So you get a sense of the value and limitation, right? And thereby the fear's objection was never quite met. You see, it wasn't nearly as harsh as I thought it was going to be, and yet there's on the other side of this, there was something very fulfilling, something very beautiful about just having a quiet moment with myself. So look for those times to start expanding your definition of what quiet can offer. Okay? And don't rush away from them too quickly by running back to the house. Okay, yeah. Anyone else? Yes.
You mentioned that desire becomes this huge bonfire, and my first thought was it just stems from not feeling like we're good enough ever.
Beautiful. That's true.
That's where it is, I think.
She says that this bonfire of desire I was speaking about in the talk stems much of its flames, or nourishes much of its flames from the sense of not being good enough. And if you think about it, what a desire says is that if I had this, you know, that it would somehow be more fulfilling than me without that. Well, that is the nature of advertisement. That's what every advertisement is meant to convey to you. Now, after living in this culture for the number of decades we each have lived here, with I don't know how many hundreds of thousands of advertisements imprinting that particular assumption upon us, what do we think we're going to be feeling at the end of this time together? That I'm not good enough if I don't have it. That I need something to be fulfilled in, I need something to be completely fulfilling for myself, to be fulfilled. So part of it is a mechanical response to the life we have lived and the culture that we live within. But there's a deeper one, a deeper level of unworthiness that somehow gets mutated from I need that for my sense of fulfillment to the belief that we're not sufficient in and of ourselves with or without it. And that can never be filled. That is like a hunger that we have. I mean, some of us go on shopping sprees to try to get some handle to that, or we open the refrigerator door to try to cover it, and it never gets filled. It never quite recedes so that it doesn't, we still feel undernourished no matter how much we try to nourish it. That has to be taken on directly. That has to be, that assumption that is conveyed by a thought and an emotion that is long lived within us. And it has been rooted in our system since we were very young. And we have followed it through habit pattern. And we have to take it on. And each one of us need to look at that assumption maturely. Write it down. I often suggest that, I don't know how many people do it, I don't think very many people, because it's probably too confronting. But you write down the language of what we tell about ourselves, the attitudes that we stay within, the emotional ambivalence that we have about ourselves. Write all those things down so you get some kind of an objective feel for what it is that compels us to move forward. And then very gently, when it's activated, sit there with it a little bit. It's like the question of quietude. Just sit there with it a little bit and be quiet with it. Instead of it moving us into the direction of the next satisfaction that never quite satisfies it, take it on itself. It needs that kind of courage response from you, that kind of committed response. All right, enough of this. Let me see what this thing's about. Okay, all. Thank you for the evening.